You're listening to a program produced in 2017 by Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place at the historic Central Library in downtown Los Angeles. Aloud is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more, please visit lfla.org/aloud. It's so appropriate to be presenting Abdullah Taya at the Los Angeles Public Library tonight because Abdullah was born in 1973 in the public library of Rabat, Morocco, where his father worked as a caretaker. He might talk about that some more tonight. I first heard about Abdullah Taya's work last year at the Penn World Voices Festival in New York. Several of my friends kept telling me about this powerful voice, Abdullah Taya, the first openly gay writer to be published in Morocco, where homosexuality is a crime. I began reading his work and was so moved by his literary daring, his testing of the porousness of boundaries. To read Abdullah Taya is to meet a remarkable cast of characters who include his fierce mother, Embarka, who protected him, who took her young Abdullah with her to weddings where he describes rivals in beauty with eyes lined with coal, covered in too much perfume. You'll meet his elder brother, the pride of his family, the recipient of his younger brother's love. There are tales of his growing up in a working-class Moroccan family, of his life in Paris, where he now lives, where upon arrival he found himself hungry to be seen in a society that rendered him invisible. He writes about his complex relationship to the French language, the language in which he writes, the language he thought could save him. He writes about his anger and his struggle as he notes to, quote, resist the clichés that surround people like me in Paris, Arabic, Muslim, and gay. Abdullah Taya has published 8 books, which include the novels Salvation Army from Semiotext and Infidels from 7 Stories. His novel Le Jour du Roi, about the death of Morocco's King Hassan II, won the 2010 Prix de Flore, and he's also a filmmaker who wrote and directed the film adaptation of his book Salvation Army. His work has been called calmly transgressive, I like that phrase, and it is truly writing that helps us understand the times we live in. And in conversation with Abdullah tonight, I have the pleasure of welcoming Stephen Rains, a Los Angeles-based poet, educator, and the first ever City Poet Laureate of West Hollywood. He's, in addition to a dozen chapbooks, he's published the collections Inheritance and Your Dead Body, Inheritance and Your Dead Body is My Welcome Mat. He edited Life is Poetry, featuring his students in the first ever autobiographical poetry workshop for LGBT seniors, and he's taught writing workshops around the country to LGBT youth and people living with HIV. So it is with great pleasure. Please join me in welcoming to the Los Angeles Public Library Abdullah Taya and Stephen Rains.
Bonsoir to all of you. Thank you very much for inviting me here. I'm going to start this event with you by reading I think 3 pages, first 3 pages from this book. So it's in English. It's going to be a little bit hard for me, but I'm going to do my best to make the words come to your ears. Nobody will come, Mamo. You know it, Mamo. It's too late or too early. The men don't come here anymore, and you know it. You know it. Isn't that true? Stop insisting. I don't want to do it anymore. Don't want anything to do with that ritual. We have been waiting a very long time. It's over. It's over. The last time we met up with a monster, he wanted to devour me. He did strange things to me. I told you. Remember? No? Really? You don't? Come on, we are going home. We are leaving, Mamo. We are leaving. The streets are empty. No one will see us hurl insults and stones at us. And if anyone spits at you, I will fight. I will defend you. I won't run away. I've grown up. I can see I have grown up. I've learned to spit at people too. Deep inside, I remember everything. I am not looking for trouble, but now if someone looks at me with evil eyes, eyes that cast spells, I know what to do. I spit. I stand my ground. I don't look down. I face them down. I spit. I spit at all those people who despise us and pretend not to know you, Maman. I spit. I spit. I spit with all my heart and soul. I spit as far as I can at the feet of my enemy and attacker, the bastard who won't let it drop, but calls after me with his cheap remarks, his tight-ass religious moralizing. I aim for Maman. I aim at the place where my attack will drive its point home. I inhale hard through my nose. I rake the bottom of my throat. I bring up all the half-dried snot from my nostrils onto my tongue. I hawk up all the filth from my lungs and mix it in my mouth with saliva. I get a big wad ready. I build up momentum. I attack. I launch my nuclear weapon. My gulp of spit is so heavy, so sophisticated, it takes a while to land and explode in the face of my enemy. Our enemies, Maman. It's like in Capitaine Majid cartoons. The action happens in slow motion. My spit is suspended in mid-air. It will stay that way forever, in the air, a serious threat to anyone who insults you, Maman. I will kill them all, blow them to pieces, pulverize them, whip them off the face of the earth, of this world, this endless night, just with what comes out of my nose. They say I am dirty. You are dirty. I am the son of a dirty woman, the son of dirty Slima. You are not dirty, Maman, my Slima. I know that. You are not dirty. I swear to you. I swear. Do you believe me? You have to believe me. I really know how to spit. What, me? Want me to prove it? I can, right now, spit all the way to that power pole. Do you want me to? I can. You say nothing? Spitting doesn't make me bad. Badly brought up. I was different from the start, right from the beginning. Let me spit and prove to you I have grown up. Let me show you how I can protect you. Look at me. Look, look. You don't like me this way? Don't worry. I am grown up, but I'll never disown you. I understand. I accept. We don't have to change. This is how we are. How you are, Maman, Slima. I am your son, forever your son. Small, big, young, old. I am your son. I want to spit. Let me. Let me. It's what they deserve, all of them. I spit on Samir and his mother. I spit on Halima and his whole family. I spit on Yusuf, Rashid, Fateh, Salim, and all the others, friends from before. I spit on the whole soccer team of the neighborhood, Lwad Al-Khanez, and the team in Hail Inbihat too. I spit on this city, Sally, and everyone who pretends they don't know you. I spit at the imam. I don't like him. He is a two-faced coward, dirty, very dirty. I don't want you to let him come to our house anymore. No more. Besides, he doesn't pay well. I spit in his face three times. No, five. The damn imam who can't even pray properly. They should send him back to primary school. He is ignorant. He needs to learn everything again. I spit at him hard. Hard. I don't want to see him again. Not ever, Maman. We don't need him, or his money, or his religion. I spit at the neighbor, Aisha, and the black skillet she's hung in her ground floor window for so long. You can see it all the time from our house. That skillet, that curse. A year ago, you told me the meaning of the skillet, the message Aisha wants to send by hanging it there, day after day and year after year, with the blackened skillet, so very black, she has been saying, "That's what you are worth, Slima, old slut. This is what I wish for you, to be burned alive over the flames in this scorched pen. For you and your son to go to the blackness forever and soon, to be cursed forever in hell, on earth, and in the hereafter." I am amazed. In the last few months, you haven't been fighting with Aisha. You gave up, Mamo. She didn't. The black skillet is still there, a permanent insult, a constant reminder of our status in this neighborhood of Hay al-Inbi'at. For the tens of thousands of people around us, we deserve our pariah's status, our grim fate, because we do nothing to change it, break out of it. Mamo, one day we'll be stoned to death by the very same people who creep to the house each night to ask your forgiveness and a bit of pleasure. You are dead. You don't exist anymore. You are evil. I am the son of evil, of sin. That's what Aisha, the curse, calls me. Son of the evil, son of evil. She always tells me to stay away from her two sons, not to touch them or even play with them. She says, "Keep your evil to yourself and your mother, Slima." But I like her sons, and they knew everything about evil long before they met me. They are not afraid of evil. I am surprised. Yes, I am surprised. You have no more desire to fight Aisha or any other. Why? Can you tell me? Why? I am grown up. I may still seem small to you, but I have grown, Mamo. Look at me. Look at me. I can fight for you, avenge you, spit day and night at Aisha and all the others, your eternal enemies, you, as you often say. But you are not answering. Why? Why? Are we going to wait here long? Until when? No one's coming. They don't come here anymore. They don't pass this way. Foreign men don't know our neighborhood now. They all go live in the Hay Salam district. That's where you'll have to go looking now, Mamo, to learn them, talk to them, negotiate with them, sing, dance, take off your clothes. Do you want us to go there? Do you need my help? Yes? No? Yes? You are still not answering, and I am tired of waiting.
Thank you for that passage. It's such a powerful way to open up the book. You've stated that everything I write about is fragments of my life. And I, how well can you spit?
Oh, I'm a specialist of that.
Are you?
Sometimes the words don't work between human beings, so you have to make yourself clear with what is your specialty.
Well, you know, I did note that the boy was bragging not about a physical strength of punching or kicking or even with a weapon, but it was something that came out of the mouth, like an insult or words.
Well, the spitting is not an he's not using them as an insult. He's using them as a weapon, an arm, something to resist with, since no one can hear him or protect him from all this evil things that is happening to him and to his mother. So as a little boy, 11 years, he can do that. So I thought when I was writing the book, I should give him his own arms, not arms or weapons that I've learned about when I was 25, when I was in Paris or something like that. I wanted him to be very, very Moroccan.
And that involves spit. All right.
And in a very nice way. To me, that's a nice way.
And, you know, even in the passage, it was just a few sentences in, and you've done this throughout your work, talking about sex and youth and very blurry consensual boundaries. So much so that in some passages I thought, oh, you know, I almost had to go back to reread what had transpired. Mm. And how did you choose to write about those incidences in that way?
You mean the incidences in this book or in general?
In general, in most of your books, in terms of underage sex and non-consent.
Well,
slightly non-consensual.
I think we learn about sex when we are very young. We know that reality of that. We don't wait until we are, I don't know, 20 to understand what sex means and how to protect ourselves from some people who want to rape you or to do bad things to you. But when I write in general, I try to separate myself as now and what was happening at when I was little. And actually, I try to stay... not to write in a very writery way. Like, I try to forget that I am a writer, and I try to write to stay very close to life. And in life, as we all know, there are not only politically correct things happening or things we are not supposed to talk about to other people in real life. In books, I think we can go freer. We can go deep, deep there. And when I say deep, it's just to remember what was going on. For instance, I grew up in a very poor family and with a lot of brothers and sisters. Although I might seem to you as a hero, I'm not. The heroes were my mother, my sisters. And when I write, when I try to construct an identity as a gay man. The people who inspire me to construct that are my mothers and my mother, and I say my mothers, yes. Even my sisters, I consider them as my mothers. So I try to always to stay faithful and true with what happened in real life. And sometimes I don't feel I am a writer. I feel like I just pick up from here, I steal, I take here, and all the good stories are already there. I just have to steal in a good way.
When you're saying stealing, though, most of it is from your own personal experience that you're mining these stories from, not necessarily other people's.
Oh, other people's too.
Okay, all right.
No, I mean, it might sound very egoistic to you, and you are right, but I'm very bored with myself very quickly. It cannot be only about myself. It has to be about other. It has to be about the world, and the sense I have of the world, of course, and the sensibility, the history. But it cannot be only about me. Of course, it's me writing and assume everything I say, including my stealing. But it cannot be only about my body or my history or even about me as a gay person. If it was only about me as a gay Arab and coming from Morocco, believe me, it will be extremely boring after two paragraphs. I have... no, I have to... And I don't know how to say this. I think maybe because as a gay man, we are pushed into a corner where we are so lonely, and we fight a lot just to escape from this loneliness. So I think when I write, I try not to stay lonely. They tell you are gay, you don't belong to here, you are a criminal, you should not speak about this. I think as a writer, the writer that I am becoming and that I am, I should go back to those places where they tell me not to be in. So I don't want to be alone again. I'm 43. I've lived already many years alone.
And could you... I like that someone clapped for that one. Like, you have a lot of support there.
No, Mike, I think as human beings, we all connect to that, gay or not gay. They always tell you, no, if you are making us feeling bad, shameful, shame on you, all these things. Yeah. Of course, we don't all have the strength to go back to that place and tell them, I want still to be with you and to incorporate what we all lived together in my books or in my life. We don't all have that strength, but I think if a gay experience means something, is that I have to take my experience of loneliness and to put other people in it and to go to them again.
Not only have you done that in your writing, but then you wrote a screenplay based on a novel and then directed it. Mm. So when talking about having the strength to go back and reflect on your earlier life and create art out of it, you also then did that visually. So you're someone who's continually revisited some very uncomfortable situations from your youth.
It's not only uncomfortable situations. I think I'm blessed. I'm gay, but I'm blessed as well. Because they tell you, of course, when you are gay, you are damned, all these things. Damned. So it takes years to understand that you are not damned. But at the same time, I'm damned, but at the same time, I'm blessed with all these stories I lived with them in Hayy Salaam, in Morocco, in my family, and the neighborhood. And I feel like until now, I'm only working on the story that happened in my house. And when I'm done, I move to the next house. That's why I'm telling you I'm a thief. I don't need to look for stories or interesting things to put into literature or into books. I just have to find the right moment and the right structure to do that. So in that house, when we were 11 persons, people living in three rooms, we had a TV, and this is the beginning of the 80s, and that in that TV, we had Egyptian movies every Friday night. And Egyptian movies, for me, is the definition of freedom itself. I mean, this is on the TV. Of course, what is outside the TV, it's something else. There are laws. But still, on that TV, I saw brave actresses. I saw wonderful melodramas, people crying. I saw crying a lot. And we all cried with them a lot. I mean, with my sister and my mother, we cried on the same stories, the same characters, the same... So how come they tell me you are gay, go away? I don't understand. Because we share the same things. It means nothing to tell you are gay, but I ate the same food with you, I cried, and the same way you did. So the images, because you are talking about, came from there. From those Egyptian movies, and they were speaking in Arabic, and I was always asking myself how they do it, how they transform our reality into these images. And I remember already very early, and I was already, I think, 11 or 12, I was already constructing movies in my head, but with the stories of my sisters and my mother and the dysfunctional family we were living in. You know, when the mother is not the mother or the father is the mother, etc. I mean, we all know about this. It's no one is in his right place or his or her right place. That is what society says. And then you enter your house, you close the door, and the chaos starts. And I think that's what is the art is about, to bring the chaos you lived in into something kind of beautifully literary. So I remember very well that, let's say, our Rita Hayworth, which is Hind Rostom, our Fatin Hamama, our Meryl Streep, and all these things, I used to do that. My sister Fatima is in Rostam because she was really slutty. And she used to use me to go to see her boyfriend, and they gave me ice cream, etc. Thus, I was waiting for
them. You're the alibi, yeah.
Yeah, but I was happy to have ice cream, so... So what they were doing, my sisters and even my mother, she was a big woman. I mean, she was, Hassan Segun next to her was nothing. she was a dictator, an outspoken dictator, talking a radio, talking all the time. So I feel like these images and these stories, I have no other choice but to put them and try to make something interesting artistically out of them. I don't feel sometimes I don't feel I am not the artist, I'm just the one, the chosen one.
Well, in terms of being chosen, in Infidels, the mother states, she was getting her hair done, she says, talking about her son, he's my memory, my forgetting. And do you feel as if you've played this role for your mother, since your mother's, you have these strong mother characters in your...
That I am her memory?
Or her forgetting as well.
I was not her favorite son, for sure, so I should take revenge now. But revealing some secrets and doing some bad things more again and again. To be honest, I cannot be only his memory. I have 9 brothers and sisters, and they have memories. They are her memories, too. I mean, to be fair. It's not because I'm a writer that I'm special. I hope I'm special, not because I'm a writer, but because I'm talented in doing other things too in life. And my other brothers, they like, for instance, when she died in 7 years ago in her funerals, one of my sisters suddenly started to talk with her voice. And she told many stories about my mother that I never knew about. And I was so shocked, angry about myself that I didn't ask my mother specific questions. I learned that before she married my father, she was married to another man during the French occupation in the 40s and the 50s, and that man was sent to fight for France in Vietnam and Indochina at that time, and he died there. And when France gave the money to his family, to that man who died, the family of that man, they kick her out, jeté, they kick her out, they took her daughter from her, and they kick her out. Mm. And this, when I learned this story, I was so shocked, so angry, because I felt I was so... focused on constructing myself, saving myself, building a career, etc., that I became, and even constructing a gay identity, that it stopped me from being curious about this woman.
So you have an open letter to your mother.
I had.
I know that you had stated that your mother is could not read. Do you know if it was ever read to her?
My mother, as I told you, was a real outspoken woman, and not shy at all, calling you and telling you whatever she wanted to tell you.
Yeah.
So when I came out as a proud gay man in Morocco, of course I had my reasons to do it, and I was put in a situation that allowed me to do it, which is very important to say. As she called, why did you say that? I didn't. She had so many reasons to justify what her message. That I really didn't know what to tell her. She didn't say you are not my son anymore, mm-hmm. at all. She didn't rejected me. She didn't reject me. She just said, why did you say that? You know that we have enemies. I told you when we were old who are the enemies, and we should not tell the enemies our secrets and our weak points. So I thought that I should make the point bigger. And I told her, well, I talk about society. And she told me, she answered, who told you that we are society? At the beginning, I thought that she's just saying something to answer, but I think she was right. Because what she wanted to say is, we are only the poor people. You know that if we speak up, they will beat us more. They will take that weak point and to use it against us. So what you are doing to be gay and proud is that is going something that is going to be used against us. So we are not the society. We are not the political society that they want us now to be in. She was saying, I refuse to enter now that society. But again, it took me 3 years after that call to understand that. She was much more clever than me.
She also played the role of messenger for your older brother, right? Your older brother.
Messenger, what do you mean?
That she relayed a message that your older brother said to stop writing about certain things.
Ah, that's a messenger. She said, your brothers and sisters, they don't like what you are saying, you know. They don't want you to write, etc. But that was not a message, I don't know. It was not a serious message. She was just repeating what they told her to tell me.
That's still a serious message, though, right? I mean, that's in terms of being silenced, asking to silence you.
Yeah, but again, my mother was analphabet, coming illiterate women, coming from the countryside. And she had to fight in to save her family from poverty. And she has to rule the family, to play the mother and the father at the same time. She had her fight to do. And suddenly, I hope you understand, suddenly me as a gay man out was making her look weak and like destroying all her life. I can understand that. I hope you can. We cannot ask from any mother. Just because I'm now comfortable in my skin as a gay person, you illiterate mother, you don't understand me. It would be really selfish to ask. I understood without call that I had, not that I should stop from doing what I have to do, but I have also to think of the situation she is living in and as well for her fights. Yeah. And somehow her fights and my fight is connected. Although she was trying to, I don't think she was trying to silence me.
Or that your brother's comment was the silencing.
My brother, I was totally angry about it, including today.
Yeah, like... Yeah.
Not only he was the favorite son, but he he got it all, and he was beautiful. He had a mustache. He had a big salary. He had a car.
You describe him as the king and your father the fallen king. In the family.
Yeah, my father was a falling king, but very romantic. In a way, he was lucky. Not any man, not any person has the ability, the luck to find someone else that is willing to save you every day. And my dictator mother was saving my father for 45 years. That's luck. I mean, until now, I didn't find anyone to save me. I have to save myself by myself. It's not luck. And I mean, as a human being, I am so jealous of my father. And he was, I think I wrote this in my books, he was not attracted to any woman but her. That's big luck for 45 years. As a gay man, I'm... Well, okay, let's not even talk about that.
We can go there if you want.
No, we have more serious things to say.
So this relationship with your brother that you do this very bold thing about talking about a young boy's kind of...
Fascinated?
Fascination and kind of erotic towards...
Fascinated and more than that?
Yeah, towards the older brother.
Well, as you told, he was the king. Yeah. When you have the king in the house, you are just looking. You start looking, and you want to see how he's like, what's the state of his skin, and what his clothes. I was so happy when he gave me his clothes. when his clothes, he doesn't like them anymore. So during many, many years, I had bigger clothes, oversized clothes. And I was so happy to... And actually, I love this idea that when I split with some men, when I leave them, I always steal some of their clothes. I think including this shirt, this is from my ex-German boyfriend. He bought it in Mexico, and I stole it for him.
Well, you also have a short...
I don't know if I'm answering your question, but... No, it's no. I mean, imagine I am 7 years old, and he is 25, and he has his own room in the house. He has the books, he has the good looking, and he's going to be an intellectual. The mother has only her heart for him, and she was incitating us to have only our eyes to him. So, I mean, he has a huge aura. We were all in love, literally, with him. All of us. Yeah. And when he entered, we were silent. That's called love, no? Silence. We can call it that way.
Are you in communication currently?
With him?
Yeah.
Well, now he started to send text messages. Oh. So, asking for money. No, not only money. No, when I say asking for money, it's very sad. When we are adults, that at a certain point, we now, as an adult, we cannot speak openly about the bones, the les blessures, the wounds. And so, strangely, there is only money that will help us to communicate. So you give money to someone, and those things you cannot say, money says it. I hope you understand. So this is the moment I'm living right now with my family. They accept me, and when I'm next to them, I swear I cannot say that I'm gay. They accepted it. I know that, because now they are calling, and they want me, they want to feed me, they say, our mother told us to keep an eye on you. I don't think she did that, but it doesn't matter. And when I am next to them, I'm still blocky. Frozen. So, and I don't know, I give this nephew a little bit of dirhams and this. So money sometimes can be that. This way to keep in touch.
When you were talking about clothing, you have a short story about Jean Starobinsky,
oui.
That you made it a point to stand next to him so your clothes would touch each other.
That's the marvelous superstition in Morocco. This beautiful, weird gestures and rituals we grew up in, that is a life and a culture, actually, not a folklore, please. So there is this ritual when someone is, I don't know, he succeeds or he wins, I don't know, he wins an Oscar or I don't know. So he wins something. So in order to get a little bit of his success, a little bit of his blessing, we call that la baraka in Morocco. You have to touch your clothes with his clothes or her clothes. So when I was in Geneva, Jean Starobinsky is a big intellectual name. And for me, he was dead. Then suddenly I was there, he was still alive. And I said, okay, this is my one opportunity to get a little bit of his intellectual baraka blessing. So I had a rendezvous with him during 2 hours, and all I could think about, how am I going to touch his clothes? But my clothes with his clothes. So you see, although I grew up and I learned French and I became an intellectual and I could read Marcel Proust and I don't know, Henry James, deep inside, what counts more is this images, this sense of life that I had in Morocco during 25 years as poor guy among these people. And I feel that's me. And that's what I learned, books, languages, French, and even English. Or it's nothing. It's just a way to say that part of my life. Because that's... I mean, it's the same for us. The first years count a lot, no? And we turn 40, it's all coming back. I'm 43.
You state that his greatest gift is curiosity.
Sorry?
You stated his greatest gift was curiosity.
Jean Starobinsky?
Yeah. What is your great gift?
What's one of
your great gifts?
I can in real life, like in the subway, during, I can fix my my brain on someone and to imagine to write a book for him during 30 minutes or and to stay with him the whole day. And I can imaginer les autres, to imagine the others during a long time, but not only in sexual fantasies, but as a book, as a... like, for instance, this thing that is still... I love, by the way, le métro, the subway. And luckily for us in Paris, we have that. It saves my days during many times. This idea that someone is standing, like sitting, and suddenly he or she stands up and starts walking. Every day, I'm still amazed and fascinated by that. And sometimes I follow people.
Is this fascinating?
We all do that, no? 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 Well, I assume that. I do that. Star stalking? Well, I think that...
Now, these stories that you create, is that what motivates you then to write? Or what are your motivators as a writer?
No, I think it's just something that I have since I am a little boy. Maybe that's why I created an ability to write. Because as you know, because you are a writer too, the writing doesn't happen when we start taking the pen and start writing. Writing starts way before, maybe years before. And you just keep focusing on that thing, that idea, that image, that story of that person during many years, and to construct the thing in our head. So maybe I think it's just like I'm just a machine. I have this programming in my head, and I can be me and while imagining a big thing for other people.
Semiotext just released a collection of your short stories from your first two books. And in addition, there is a new essay in the back that was recently written in 2017, and it has a much different tone.
Can you describe
than your other work? I was in hopes you would. But one of the quotes from it is, for a writer, there is no salvation in writing. And you also state that you wanted... to learn French because you wanted to use it as a weapon?
Well, first, it's true. There is no salvation for a writer to write a book. For some people, it's therapeutic, I know that. Mm-hmm. But for me, I don't understand when people say that. I don't see what is therapeutic about that because I published many books, and every time a book appears, I feel like this is not only it ate me, but I have no other solution but to go darker, writing love, art in general, loves dark things. So I feel like my neuroses as a person in real life are not resolved at all, but art, books, are using me to make something beautiful. So the salvation, I don't think we write for salvation anyway. I think, and I repeat myself, salvation has to happen in real life. Otherwise, there is no... I don't like this idea, actually, that, you know, you say that he's a writer, he understands more than the others. Mm-hmm. That art, he's into art, and means that art is only for him or people like him. This is not my definition at all for writing or for art. For me, art was my mother. For me, books were my aunt, who was prostitute and was storyteller. For me, painting is my sister's. You know, it's art. It's only the. It's also someone walking in the streets. I'm sorry, but that's, and believe me, people in Morocco, they know how to walk in the streets. So I used to follow a lot of people in Morocco.
And when you were trying to learn French, you kept journals. Apparently you were writing in journals.
Yeah, yeah. Alors, to go back to the second part of your question, weapon. To make it short, I'm coming from a poor family, so French language was not for us. Morocco, until today, it's half of the people are still illiterate. So, and the way I learned about French was that it's something for the elite, and I didn't want to go there because I just assumed that it's not for me, and even if I tried to even speak with it, people would laugh at me. Because the way I would speak about it sounds ridiculous, and so I think I hated French when I was a little boy. Mm-hmm. But that, because of this reason, it's a language that, as it is used in Morocco, to make it clear, I hope it's clear. So I hated French, and then I started to have this dream, a silly dream, to become a filmmaker. And then I discovered that there is this famous school in Paris to who you can go to. And so I said, okay, and one day I will go there. So, okay, let's learn about this hateful thing. And I decided to study French literature in the university. And when the first day I was there, I really it was the confirmation of that I was terrible. I was terrible, really. And so my intuition, my instinct told me to stay and to try to face this thing, to fight with this thing. So actually, when you say journal, it sounds fancy. But it was not fancy at all. It was just un cahier, book note, where I was just trying things. And I was for many years just copying other phrases in. And little by little, that actually what changed me into a writer. I had no desire to be a writer.
Were those stories that you then collected in the Red Fez, or this was just kind of a different kind of writing?
You mean in the journal?
Yes.
It was a chaotic thing happening there, copying things, trying to be film critic. I was doing critics of films, and I think little by little somehow. And I'm sure it's the same for you. It happened the same for you. It's not that you decide that you are a writer, that you are a writer. It is experience. It's exercise. You exercise. You write during many, many years. And suddenly something opens up. And your inner writer self comes out. So this is what happened to me. But I think if I told myself when I started that journal, okay, I'm going to be a writer, nothing would have happened. This is fascinating, no? That's how creativity comes out. It's not only with the decision that we made consciously. There are also all the other things that are happening in you at the same time without you knowing about them. No?
Yes, definitely. And I'm just being cautious of the time. I have other questions for you, and then just another question will open up to the audience for questions. You know, since filmmaking was one of the motivators for you to start writing, you know, now that you have one film out in the world, do you still have desires to make films? Are you very pleased right now with just writing books, or where are you?
No, the big dream is movies. it's still the movies. But as you know, we are in Los Angeles, Hollywood.
Yes.
The movies are very difficult to make. Really, it's really the hardest thing for me to make. Not only to find money, but I don't know how to say this. It's because it's, to make a film, that's what I learned when I did it.
Yeah.
It's not only to write a screenplay, but when you are in a set, you have to create life, not to act. You, of course, people are acting, but if they are only acting, that's not good. So you have to invent something, way to direct them, to impose something on them, but yet, when you make them come up with something that is look like life, that is life. And believe me, that's extremely hard with all the people around and all the money that is spent every day. So yeah, the big dream is still movies. Movies, movies,
this
movies.
Is a good town to say that in. This is a good town to say that you want to make films in. I want to let you know. I set that up for you. Now we're going to open it up for audience questions. There's a microphone going around the room if anyone has a question.
Hi, my name is Karen, and I'm a native Angeleno, and I thank you for your courage in coming out as a gay Muslim.
Merci.
And as I look around this room, I don't see any woman wearing a hijab. And the West is very different when it comes to sexual liberation, even though we do have slut shaming in the West, as opposed to the Middle East, where there are openly so-called honor killings. And I just wanted your take as to some of the factors that you think the Middle East needs to become as sexually liberated as the West?
First of all, I don't think the Middle East or the Muslim world need to be liberated in sexually in the same way as in the West. In the West, things happen there is a movement in the history of its place. I'm not condemning the sexual liberation in the West. I'm part of it. And I beneficiate from it. That's very important. But I cannot go back to Morocco. For instance, I get a lot of emails from young gay people in Morocco. They are 12, 14, or 15. They tell me that they live hell, and they ask me, should they come out to tell their parents they are gay and their friend? And it, when they are 14 or 15, I tell them, don't do that. Don't come out to your parents. That will be just hell for you. I have to understand where they are living. If they do that, it means that will be much more danger for them. Much more, it will be just me that I have the chance to be in a place where I am protected by the laws as a free person, sexually and individually, trying to impose that on someone who has now not the same right, not the same laws protecting him or her. So what I tell him, try to be free in yourself. You are free. You are gay or something. You are this, but be free. Try to be between you and you. And try to be independent. One day like this, you could escape from this place, this home, not necessarily to come to the West or to France, because I don't think all the people in Morocco or in the Middle East, they dream about Paris or London. I don't think that so. There are a lot of people who just they don't want freedom, but they stay in their countries. So I want them to be sexually free. I want them to actually not to be sexually free. What I want for them in Morocco, I want to have the laws that protect them as individuals, sexually and as individual. So when I hear about the sexual freedom that should be as the same as in the West, where I live now for 19 years in Paris, and believe me, I have problems even with that in Paris. There are things that are not okay for me. So I hope I'm not shocking you by telling you all these things, but I have to be criticized with a critic about these things. The places, the countries, the civilizations, they have their own coherent movement, and I'm not telling you that I should not speak up when I'm in Morocco, but at the same time, when doing that, I have to acknowledge the history, what is going on there. Otherwise, it will be only imperialism. It's very important. And again, I'm not saying that I'm against the liberation here. I love Gus Van Sant and Marilyn Monroe, there's no problem. And I'll enjoy having sex with the Muslims and Jewish people and Catholic and Methodist. So I'm beneficiating from that freedom. But I don't want to be arrogant when speaking about with other people. If I had to help them, I have to listen to them and to try to find the right solution for them. Because they, not only they are not protected by their own political people, but there is also this, I'm sorry to say, this arrogance coming from the West, that when they speak about the Middle East and the Africans, it sounds that they are savages. And believe me, they are not savages. My sisters, I told you about the examples of my freedom. I found them when I remember my sisters, the transgression, I didn't find them in the books, or I found them in Marilyn Monroe, example. That's West, but a good West, good example from the West. I hope it's clear. It's a very complicated issue, but I don't want to be, because I'm an Arab, Muslim, and gay, to be the one used against my own people. That's very important. I don't think art is here to only make me look good against the others.
There's another question.
Many of your characters are sort of in between society or fighting with society, or there's a fuzzy boundary between the family and the society and the inner world of your characters. Mm-hmm. And when you say that your mother asked you who told you that we are society, I wonder, where do you place your own childhood, your own family, or your own household, your own, or even that of your characters within Hay Salaam, or within Morocco, or just within this world? Where are those boundaries?
I place it in one room, in one small little room in that house with 11 people, three rooms. So I the ones who read my book, they all already know about this intimate, complicated geography of me. So one room is the exiled father, one other room for the silent king, the big brother, and the last one was for us, six sisters, my mother, that's seven, little brother, eight, and me. And I lived there with them, I think, 16 or 17 years. So I feel when I'm right, and my sense of life and the world, and I am surrounded by all these bodies, and we are all crumbling. Earlier I said that there is not only my voice or my story. I feel like the vibrations from the bodies of my sisters, they are all in me. I'm a very transgender in a way. So I feel all these stories, all what happened to them, the physical changes that I witnessed, the screams, the fights, the moving moments, the eating, the change in clothes. I knew their bodies naked, and they knew my body naked. I saw my mother used to watch to change her clothes in front of me, and this was not something shame to do. It was natural. So I tried to put that natural thing I had in that room and to put it in the book. I'm aware of the fact that this is not natural for so many people, and it's not for the political people, for the ones, the Muslim people, the Arab people, and all these things. But again, we are Muslims, we are Arabs, we are Moroccans, and I am gay in the middle of them. And again, I told you, I don't want to be alone. I want my sister to be next to me. No, it's this idea that a writer has to be alone and to be... it's not for me. Believe me, it's not for
the
me.
The tortured artist, the isolated writer.
Well, I'm very tortured, yeah. But... But my sisters are much more. Because, you know, it's just, I'm sure you experience the same things. When you think that you are nothing, that nothing is happening to you, and your sisters and people around you are living extraordinary things. Just the way they change their clothes, just the way they, they make cooking. That the way they try to manipulate me, and me accepting or not accepting, negotiating, and that's the way they want me to do evil things. Sorcery, for instance, magnificent sorcery. They used to put, you would tell me to go this and to go to that house and to put sorcery in the front door of that house because they have some target there in that house, men, of course. So I was used that way. Isn't that beautiful? I know all about evil and I'm so happy.
There's a question. Hi, my name is Ani Zonneveld and I am Muslim, so I'm not hijab, but just that was a stereotype that I did not appreciate. I really, I advocate for LGBT rights in the context of Islam, and the work that we do in the Muslim world is advocating for and pushing for LGBT rights, and yes, like as you had explained, the concept of LGBT is also a Western construct. But how do we move the society in the Muslim world, as someone from the Muslim world myself, to be more pluralistic in our society, in our thinking? I mean, this is a very long, drawn-out work that we have to do. The fact that you have come out as gay is actually very important. And yes, you have the privilege in the society that you live in. And I'm very appreciative of the fact that in your storytelling tonight, how nuanced you are.
How?
That nuance.
Nuance.
And that it's not just about, you're talking about yourself, it's not just about me coming out as gay and my right to be gay and open, but it, how does it affect my family? And the fact that we have LGBT Muslims here in the United States also that experience this, they cannot come out, they cannot live their true self because of their concerns for their family, the backlash. How do we come around this saving the family's face? You know what I'm talking about. How do we come around this cultural issue? It's and then also it's the historical context is also very important. This is a very big question I'm asking you, and I'm sorry, but I'm not expecting the bullet answer. But the historical context of imperialism and colonialism, and how the criminalization of homosexuality came to the Muslim world from the British, from the French, from the Spanish. Right? We didn't have this. So
the Puritanism, European Puritanism came to these countries with the colonialism and stayed there.
So I have a request. Can you write a book that draws this historical... You will do miracle in two things. You will actually educate the West, as someone, a Muslim in the West, of their historical...
So there's a question and request, right?
Yes.
So you have...
And then the other part, too, is that you will actually educate Muslims themselves about, hang on a second, we didn't criminalize homosexuals before.
You know what? This is so much. I know it's so important. There's so much. So not only is he going to answer a question, but then also write a book. maybe you want to kind of address some of the points that she was mentioning.
But there is, I think there is one answer to this, what you said. It's a political one. The people who are controlling the countries, Muslim countries, Arab countries, let's say for me, what I know most about Arab countries, most of them are dictators, and they don't want their own people to be free and to give them the rights, the laws that protect that. So when you have this big thing that is controlling people, people like Moroccans, they think this thing... They are not free, they should not be in the right Muslim this way. Not only for gay people, but as well for them as heterosexual, free, etc., etc. But me, and I think I gave many examples tonight, when I speak, like tonight, or when I write, I speak from this real life happening, my sisters, what they're doing, me, again, and of course the suffering that I didn't talk a lot about the suffering tonight, but I think you would guess easily about it. So at a certain point, you understand that the people, they just try to protect themselves in a specific political, sociological situation. And they know if they say this or they talk about this, they will be harmed politically. This thing will be used against them politically. So the changes, it's not to say just, okay, let's have sexual liberation in the Arab world. That's not enough. In a way, it already exists, believe me. somehow, much more than in some places I know. But at certain point of the analysis of the situation, we have to face the political people, the presidents, the ministers, the rich people, the elites, why they are leaving these countries without laws protecting these own people. And I think I'm just one human being, and I try to do what I can, like tonight, speak with nuances, as you said. Thank you.
I would like to thank everyone for coming out tonight. We will be signing, Abdella will be signing books in the lobby. Please definitely pick up your copy of Infidels, as well as the new collection of short stories, Another Morocco. And I would also like to thank Louise and Aloud for putting on this evening.
And me too. I want to thank you very, very much. Thank you, Stephen, to thank Louise, to thank all the crew. I was born in a library, she didn't lie. So to be in this library is a big thing for me. So I thank you very warmly for coming. Thank you. Thank you.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, Julia Meltzer, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM. Music by Boya Pongo. Support these free programs by becoming a member of the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Visit lfla.org for more information.